From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway, an opportunity for commentary, analysis, and if we are lucky, I always say, some insight into the media issues of the week. Welcome, welcome. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Sir?
Sir, it's great to talk to you. Sir. I'm just thinking about the dunes on Fire Island.
Oh, boy. Oh, dear. Okay, more on that, maybe. And here with us today, the inimitable, the one and only Stu Shinsky. Here he is, Stu Shinsky, the former editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal, now editor, marketer, digital marketing guru.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. How you doing?
Doing great. Wonderful to be back with you, gentlemen. I'm your most loyal listener, I must say.
Well, that's
and I never miss a minute.
And you do. I know you do.
That's a great thing. So here's something where you can have some expertise. From your years in the newspaper industry, there's a provocative headline that I want to read to you to begin our conversation. What if the newspaper industry made a colossal mistake? That's the headline on an article in Politico by the analyst Jack Schaefer. And here is his question. I will just pose this to you. It's just published today as we speak. A new paper written by a couple of researchers at the University of Texas who say that the newspaper industry has, in pursuing a tech-heavy web strategy, has been a bust, that the newspaper's future might reside in its past.
In print.
In print and not in smartphones, iPads, and VR. Digital first, the authors claim, has been a losing proposition for most newspapers.
Well, I would say this. I would say the headline is, shall we say, inaccurate, because I think the newspaper industry has made several colossal mistakes. I really do. And yes, even in these days of late 2017, it is no secret that newspapers generate the far majority of their revenue from print advertising, even though it's falling and falling quickly in many aspects. And other revenue models have popped up, such as circulation and subscriptions and events and stuff like that. But the digital revenue that they're bringing in, it's growing, but it's not nearly going to sustain all those staffers that you need, all those costs that you have. So did the industry make a mistake? Well, they made several mistakes. The first one, it goes back to not charging for content when the internet came around, where they sort of said, we charged you for 200 years to get our content. Now we're going to give it to you for free in 1996 and 1997 on our web page. That's when the revenue doors really started to get blown off because they made a colossal mistake.
And so now what is trying to happen is newspapers are trying to recover more money from consumers than they did for years, as you say, by charging digitally, but also by hiking the price of the newspaper, the print product, in order to try to get more of a realistic price for what it costs to produce that thing.
Right. And in many cases, they're offering less content for that higher price. And obviously, there's economic models in there and budgeting that come to play. But if you look at where the newspaper industry is thriving on the print side, the first word that comes up are those wonderful four words, the New York Times, which gives great content, even if some dispute that, gives great content, gives value for your subscription dollars. And I think a lot of newspapers have lost their way regarding the value of content, where the content has simply gotten whacked in the revenue shortfalls that have come about. And reporters go out the door, content doesn't show up, there's less reason to buy the paper, but the price is higher, so there's even more reason to not buy the paper.
And obviously it skews old, right?
Yes.
In other words, you know, I get up at my usual, my first wake up is around, I get up at about 7, so my first wake up is about 12. And I read both the Washington Post and the New York Times, cover to cover. And I'm always astounded by how good the New York Times is. It's a wonderful newspaper. It really is. I've had my issues with them, but, you know, it's a wonderful newspaper. Then I read the Washington Post, which everybody is acclaiming to be, you know, up there with it. It's not the same. It's just not the same. It's good. It's all right. But they don't have the same kind of comprehensive investigative stuff that we have in the Times. And, you know, so I think you're right, Stu. It is the New York Times carries the industry. But you guys, when I talk to you at the you or the guys at the Berkshire Eagle, they always tell me, well, things may be rough, but we're still making money.
Yeah. Exactly, which is one of the points that Jack Schaefer makes in this Politico article. Newspapers got accustomed to such high margins. You know, the Buffalo News is the great example, which is, of course, owned by the Sage of Omaha. And the Buffalo News used to have a margin of about 45% a year. That's outrageous. Well, that's fabulous. But the question is, can newspapers be satisfied perhaps with single-digit margins, the average publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange has a margin of about 6%. So what if newspapers were to settle for a single-digit profit margin?
And also, how are you getting to that profit margin? Are you getting there through revenue growth, or are you getting there through expense cuts?
Interesting.
The top line is obviously all the revenue you bring in. The bottom line is the profit that you make. Mm-hmm. And you're referring to the profit margin. And a lot of times that profit margin is built upon the savings that you have made through cuts.
But those cuts are inevitably stupid, because you're basically committing suicide, right? I mean, when you the fewer resources you have, why would anybody read the paper if there's so much less in it?
Right.
Now, the Berkshire Eagle, where I write a column, they have found a bunch of people with a lot of money who have put that money into that product, and they keep hiring, and they're still making money.
Excellent. Excellent news. And there may well be a key element. Local ownership of the Berkshire Eagle may be what it really needed to get out from under that ownership of a heavily indebted company that needed to keep cutting spending in order to pay the debt service.
Although, isn't there a question of, if you get a bunch of local billionaires who will put their money into it, isn't there some point at which those billionaires are going to say, I want this story in the paper?
I don't know. We're pretty resistant to that.
You're not there.
No, but the newspaper industry in general, we resist advertisers. You know, we get our money from advertisers, and they don't have any call on telling us what to publish. You resist funders. You have some big donors here, and you don't let them tell you what to air WAMC. Yeah. So I think we can be independent.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've worked with been fortunate to work with many wonderful publishers in my career, and yes, there are things they'd like to have in the paper. The question is, you know, is it a story or is it an agenda? And I think when sometimes a publisher may have some insights on something, yeah, this is worth covering, okay, from a news side. But then it's also, you know, yeah, I think what we're worried about is when the agenda dominates the news content and flows from the editorial page into news columns, where it obviously should just never do.
Well, here's an interesting example that I will tell you from my personal experience. Just recently, the announcement was made that the Arena Football League is expanding to include a franchise here in Albany. And one of the owners of that franchise is my publisher, George Hurst. Now, we covered it extensively because it's a big deal for this community. When the Arena Football League was previously active in this market in what used to be called the Pepsi Arena, now the Times Union Center, that was the most successful sports franchise Albany ever had. They would get 13,000 people a night. Albany won the playoffs of the Arena Football League, and it was a really big deal. And so the sense of the people who were bringing back the Arena Football League is that this will again be a big deal. So we played it as a big story. But I have to assert that it was not because of George Hurst's involvement. It was almost in spite of it. You know, we had to really think, is this really big? Yes, this is really big for us. The same way that it was a big deal when we got single-A baseball in this community, because we knew how popular it would be, even though it's a lower level in the sport than what other baseball teams might be. We knew that would be a big deal. But it is hard sometimes to resist the impulse of your funders, I would think. But so far, so good, you know. So Stu Shinsky here from Poughkeepsie. I'm Rex Smith from Albany. And Alan Shartok is here from WAMC. If you want to share your thoughts, media at WAMC.org. And here, for example, Blair from Greenville writes to us. Hi, I was lucky enough to listen to the program today. I believe there's an assault on the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights in general. In my opinion, it's important to stop referring to our country as a democracy. It is not and never meant to be. It is a constitutional republic with a democratic election process. Far too many people think of it as a democracy, and the difference is huge. Democracy is basically mob rule. The Bill of Rights, rather, protects one from the many. Professor?
Let's defer to our political scientist on that one.
Yeah, I would accept that. I mean, you know, these definitional questions are always difficult. But we certainly are not a pure democracy, and they're right about the letters right about you. Perfect democracy would be everybody, you know, having a hand in every decision. Yeah, mob rule probably doesn't happen, but I do think we have a democratic model in this country in which we either go towards it or away from it, and I think we're going away from it right now. I think one of the principles of this republic, if that's what you want to say, is freedom of the press. I've never seen our Rex so angry I mean, this is a guy who doesn't get angry, and at least that I see, only me sometimes. But it's amazing. You know, when they come after the First Amendment, you really are hurting.
When the president the other day, what was it that was so...
He wanted to take away the
license. He said, "Let's pull the license
the
of NBC."
License.
Yeah,
which of course
outrageous.
Is the
outrageous. Outrageous. Anyway, because he doesn't like the way they cover him, and you know, all the networks, CBS, ABC, NBC, and CNN, he says, they're all fake news, he tweeted day before yesterday. The only one, apparently, that's not fake news is Fox. How about that?
Yeah.
This is like the marching band, you know, with all the, everybody's in step except for that one kid, and the parent of that one kid who's out of step says, look at my Johnny over there, the only one who's in step.
I put a lot of belief in the Cartoon Network myself, actually.
The Cartoon Network, what a guy. Here's a listener, Joanna, writes to say, I listened to a pre-recorded program on WAMC the other day, that would be us, I guess, one in which the topic was how declining trust in the press is frightening and whether journalists are completely free to write whatever they want. The position of the panelists seemed to be on the side of pointing out how journalists are subject to checks and balances and so must take a responsible approach to the articles they write and print. I'm writing in to voice a different approach. Are you kidding, writes Joanna. Have you seen the National Enquirer lately?
And that gets to the classic point of what people think the media is.
As if it's one thing.
Right. Where we're all one big fat glob. We're all the media. Instead of a local community journalist, a national radio correspondent, the Poughkeepsie Journal, the Albany Times-Union, the Kingston Freeman, the Troy Record, we're not in the same class as the National Enquirer. We're just not. We tell the truth. At least we do our best.
Yeah, I think the standards of editing and truth-telling are very different from what we were discussing, the way stories are created. And the First Amendment protects the right of the National Enquirer to be irresponsible, and Breitbart News, and whomever else you may.
But not to not be sued, as we know.
Right.
If you say something that's really wrong and hurtful, you can get sued, and Gawker, right, it's happened.
Gawker died.
Yeah, as a result of this. But I know that even staff members here and loved ones that I have said, did you see that? That was terrible. You know, that shouldn't be allowed.
Shouldn't be allowed.
And so what we have is a country where respect for the press is de minimis. I mean, it is very low. And so when we get a letter like that, it's an important letter because it basically tells you where a lot of people's heads are at.
Mm, yeah.
Well, you said, yeah. Well, what do you mean by that? You mean I don't like what you just said? What do you mean? No. You think it's not true?
No, I think it's true. Actually, I was just thinking about this story that we were reading the other day about what ordinary people define as fake news. The president uses this term fake news to mean something different than what we're talking about, stuff that wasn't real during the election about Hillary Clinton and the child sex ring at a pizza parlor in Washington. You know, this is different from what people generally think.
You know, this fake news thing came around when newspapers were at a very vulnerable point economically, where there was financial weakness and the newspapers were getting undercut in many ways by tech innovation. And they didn't have the staff, and in a lot of cases, they didn't have the resources, other than the big guys, of course, to do the job that many felt they had long done. And then the fake news comes along, and a lot of newspapers don't have, frankly, the wherewithal to create fake news. And most journalists in America, folks, are community journalists.
Well, the Russians seem to have enough resources.
They certainly did, but for the clickbait stuff that came up, it's garbage. Just garbage. It has nothing to do with journalism. Mm-hmm. It's sensationalistic with an agenda and a financial motive.
I don't know. You know, that's easy to say, Stu, but when somebody reads the New York, P-O-S-T, it's a name I don't like to use, and you see, you know, semi-clad people, I've raised this before here, on page after page, and it's successful. I mean, people want to see what those semi-clad women look like. It's disgusting that that's the way you sell a newspaper, but if that's the bottom line, that's what they do.
But, you know, here's the difficulty. When you get real carefully reported stories that the president denounces as fake news, people begin to believe that it can be applied, that it's a term that applies to all kinds of stuff.
That's right.
Let's talk a little bit about the recent revelations involving sex abuse. Sexual harassment. Let's look at, for example, the Bill O'Reilly story. Here we've got a recent revelation that Bill O'Reilly paid a $32 million settlement.
That's staggering to me. $32 million
settlement. That's the cost of doing business, don't you know?
That's like baseball player salary.
That's just
money.
To one particular woman. There had been other allegations long before that. And after he paid that $32 million, Fox still signed him to another $25 million a year contract. A pretty stunning.
But he's not there now, right? I mean,
he's not there now. They finally got rid of him.
Now we're hearing that Sinclair Broadcasting,
one of
the largest of the broadcasting behemoths, may hire him. That's a published report. Doesn't come from me, but we are reading that. That's incredible. We don't care if this guy has gone around doing this terrible stuff. We just know that a lot of people want to hear him.
Well, a lot of people
don't care.
I mean, the president of the United States was elected, notwithstanding significant allegations about his misconduct sexually and stuff that we heard on tape, his own self-admission of how he would assault women sexually. That was assault that he described. So it does raise a question. Is the media focusing on Harvey Weinstein and Bill O'Reilly and so on? Does the public really not care about this? Is this something that we shouldn't be spending as much attention on?
Let me just say, Rex, I think some of this stuff is in itself salacious. They think it's selling things because they give specifics about the guy masturbated and he was standing, he ripped my clothes off and he was masturbating and he overpowered me and he did stuff you cannot say on the radio. You cannot say on the radio. I'm wondering every time I see that stuff whether that isn't the purpose of this huge coverage, not only to expose this terrible man for what he did, but also to sell papers because of the specifics that they're using.
Salaciousness sells. Clickbait works, frankly. But don't forget, you know, these are businesses. And if they think, just like Fox gave O'Reilly all that money after he paid out that $32 million settlement, this is a business. You know, NBC got rid of Brian Williams because they felt it would hurt the bottom line. CBS got rid of Dan Rather because they felt the allegations with President Bush at the time would hurt the bottom line. So the dollars win all the time.
Well,
not at the Times Union. Not at the Times
Union.
Not
at the Times Union.
The fact of the matter is,
journalist, but
there will be people.
Yeah.
I mean, I have such great respect for that newspaper because I do, because you and your colleagues do not put the salacious stuff, you know, out front. And obviously there's enough money behind the newspaper, and the newspaper has a tremendous place in its community, the capital region of New York, so that you don't have to. And you're not in a really terrible competitive situation. You may have some minor league competitors, but that's the way it is. So, Rex, I think you don't have to, but a lot do.
Well, thank you. It's interesting. I mean, the difficulty is that some stories are just by their very nature sensational. And even if you are not trying to be sensational, it is sensational. We did a story recently, of course, and the New York Times has similarly covered this group called NXIVM, N-X-I-V-M, which is based here in the Capital Region. And we did a big series on NXIVM 5 years ago about questions about how it operates. I'm speaking very carefully because everything that we have done on this is vetted quite thoroughly through our First Amendment lawyers to try to avoid litigation.
And then, of course, the New York Times picked it up, right, and did quite a story on it. But I didn't understand it because I thought that was your story. Did they just print your story?
No, no. They picked it up then. They went further with it. They found someone who talked about branding, women who are branded in connection with this organization.
Branded meaning with an
literally,
iron.
Yeah. Not tattoos, yeah. But with brands. And we subsequently carried that a little bit further and did more reporting about it. But that's a sensational story. We ran a photograph of the brand on the front page. Women are branded near their genitals. It's a terrifying notion. And I think people need to know about it. And the state of New York ought to be called to account for whether, in fact, the state did the right thing. Did the state step forward and protect patients of the doctors involved in this process, or did it not? So that's newsworthy. That story is intrinsically sensational, but we didn't trumpet it as being some big sensational finding. We didn't, you know, you have to just do it responsibly, I think. This sex abuse stuff, you know, Bill O'Reilly claims that it's all when he was confronted in an interview with the New York Times on their podcast. They have this really fine podcast called The Daily. He said, this is crap, and you know it. It's politically and financially motivated, and we can prove it with shocking information. This is about his $32 million deal. I'm sure that he just pushed out $32 million because it wasn't true, right?
I wonder how many people implicitly or explicitly threaten to sue a newspaper who actually do it.
Yeah.
In other
it's
words,
very few. Yeah.
I'm sure you used to get all these letters,
never.
Right?
I had to deal with many folks who, I mean, if you just ran a simple police brief about someone's arrest, I got a lawyer, you know. It's like, oh, okay, well, you do what you want to do. But very rarely is there actually a lawsuit.
Yeah.
Most lawyers will say, you got no case.
Yeah. Because people don't understand that the First Amendment even protects our right to be wrong sometimes, right. Which we try not to be. And if you're the New York Times or any other news organization going forward with a story about a $32 million settlement involving Bill O'Reilly, if you're using leaked court documents, that is privileged material. That means you can't be sued based upon what's in those court records.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's right. When you say we have even a right to be wrong, you don't want to be wrong, and you want to have some methodology where somebody who did something or a newspaper who did something is held accountable for that, right?
And that's the credibility question. I mean, the enemy of fake news is credibility.
Uh-huh.
And the opposite, and that's what newspapers have many, and media organizations, not just newspapers. Credibility is how you build and sustain your reputation. And unfortunately, as the financial fortunes of media organizations change, it's tougher to be as complete as you were. It's tougher to be as authoritative as you were. And sometimes that may affect your credibility in some people's eyes, so the fake news darts get a little pointier and sharper.
So, Stu, since you're not here very often, what else do you want to talk about today? What's going on? You know, we're in the last couple of minutes of the show. What's important?
Well, I have to say, I am fascinated. I'm not in the direct newsroom anymore, but I'm still obviously in love with this craft that has sustained my career for so many decades. What I am fascinated by these days is how journalism education is changing, how colleges are looking to take the very traditional and core educational tenets of here's how you write a story, here's how you edit a story. And now it's technological training. That I think there's a lot more reasoning and abstract investigative training that's taking place. There's a great deal, I think, of interest out there of the new wave of journalists who they don't write news stories. They do storytelling. They tell video stories. Videos are huge. And videos are revenue producers. So what I am, and I've done a lot of reading on this on my own, but what I really find fascinating is what is a journalist going to look like in 10 years?
Yeah, and you know what? We can talk about this in a subsequent show because we're almost out of time. But I have to tell you, I'm not all that pleased with journalistic education.
I'm not either, but it is changing. The question is, are as many people going into it? Can they sustain? Are they? Okay. And can they sustain a career? I mean, I've been doing this for 35 years, maybe longer. How old am I?
Not as old as the rest of us in this room. Yeah.
What time is it? But where is it going to go? Where's journalism going to go?
Well, it's also a question, and I'll give you a hint for the next time we talk about this, with the professors as opposed to with the students.
Interesting. Provocative thought. More on that to come. Stu Shinsky is here from Poughkeepsie. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
A pleasure. A pleasure, gentlemen.
Wonderful to see you. Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. Always wonderful.
Thanks, Rex, and thanks, Stu. It's always great to see you.
I'm Rex Smith in the Times Union. Thanks for joining us this week on The Media Project.
Readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.